Thanks. It's definitely been a pleasure, and I'm looking forward to a sort of another walk on the beach today, you know, the weather and the... Anyway, so I picked this title, Realizing the Potential. So it's like this towards, you know, towards the structure and so on. Realizing is a great description. It means that you haven't realized it yet. But the fact that there is potential means it's hopeful. I thought it's a bit like the Center for Integrative, you know, Biology. So integrative and realizing, they're both sort of, you know, ambiguous. You can succeed without actually arriving. But anyway, that was the... And then I thought I'd also... What I'd try and do was, rather than get into a lot of detail, which, of course, we're all terribly interested in, and I'm sure these 30 ideas are probably only 10, but they're so detailed to be quite boring to some people. So I thought today I would try and be, you know, have more of a sort of umbrella overview and try and explain how we think about doing electron cryomicroscopy in a way that relates the different approaches. And I normally only in our own work we try and work on only on sort of things with even symmetry, in other words two-dimensional or zero-dimensional structures. And I've tried to keep clear of helices because it's got all those Bessel functions that the helix people like. But I thought I'd just touch on it because there are common messages in terms of how much information you need, which is the same independent of the arrangement of the molecules whose structure you're interested in. But I thought I'd add in a little bit of a sort of theoretical view on how well, if you have an overview of how cryo-EM works, it ought to apply equally well to tomography, where you only have one picture or one tilt series. So I'm going to try and touch briefly on each of those topics. And because today I'm not showing you this little EM simulation program, I shouldn't run out of time today. So the slides I was going to show yesterday and ran out of time, I've squeezed them into today's talk. So I'm going to hopefully be able to tell you everything I planned. So I thought it'd also be good to sort of give the take-home message before we look at a bit of data. So on the next, just again, it's just text really, but the idea is that people have been doing electron crystallography for a long time, non-biological crystallography for even longer, and there are quite a number of structures, one of the other thoughts behind this is I did recently write a very, very short 4 or 5 page review, which caused me to have to read all the papers that had structures by crystallography or helical or single particle analysis that are at reasonably sort of beyond 10 angstrom resolution. So I'll show you the results of this effort. So it's a sort of, in a way, it's a talk based on a little mini review, which isn't out yet, but will be. So there are a number of structures from 2D where people have been able to reach 3 or 4 angstrom resolution. But actually, there's nothing about what you do in terms of the theory of the electron microscopy or the image processing that says you should be limited to 3 angstroms. So there isn't really any theoretical limit. On the other hand, you're using the fact that it's a crystal. And if you've got a disordered crystal, you only get spots out to the resolution at which you have the order, just like an X-ray diffraction. You make your crystal, it looks beautiful, you diffract it and it's got 3 spots. Very disappointing. But others you diffract and it's thousands of spots. So again, with the crystallography, you're sort of limited by the specimen rather than the methodology. And then your molecules may well form beautiful tubes or helical arrays. And again, there are a couple of structures now, and I'll touch on them, where people have reached resolutions good enough to build atomic models. But again, there's nothing about what you do in the imaging or the processing or the theory that says you shouldn't be able to do it at any resolution you want. Again, you're limited entirely by the behavior of your molecule in making a well-ordered specimen, because the theory of the image processing requires you to know about the helical nature of it. So certain things that are not helices cannot be analyzed by that method. And then single particles, obviously you can get them with 2-2-2 symmetry or no symmetry like the ribosome. And again, you take pictures of them, you average them, you get a structure. And the best people have been able to do up to now are 6 to 10 angstrom resolution structures. And obviously the ones with more symmetry, there are more of them and they're easier to do, and there are less pitfalls with that, because if you've got a really big particle with a lot of symmetry, there's a lot of information there, it's hard to get things wrong. There's no sort of model bias and so on. So the ones that have a lot of symmetry are more reliable. And again, there's not really any limit other than, in the methodology, other than you do need your single particles whose images you're going to align. You need them to be above a certain size. You obviously need enough of them. And if they're not identical particles, in the same way that if they're not identical in the crystal or helical array, then you can't really average them because the bits that are different will be blurred. So there are limitations, but they're nothing to do with the methodology. They're to do with the behavior of your object. And then whatever you're doing, X-ray crystallography, electron crystallography, and so on, in the end, there are all sorts of little subtle variations on the idea that the thing you're interested in has a structure, which might be quite interesting. It might be a structural change that's part of the mechanism, a series, 10 intermediates, so you have to trap them. And then you're into quite interesting science. But at least for these talks, the idea is to focus on what you can do with the methodology. And then finally, I thought I'd put in a bit about tomography. And a number of groups, for example, Wolfgang Baumeister's group, David Agard, Dick McIntosh and so on, Boulder, and there are probably others, have done a lot of really great work developing the methodology. And in our lab, there's one person doing it, but the resolutions people are getting are 40, 50, 60 angstrom. And I'll say a little bit about what it looks like from looking at the theory of how you get the images and so on, and signal to noise, that you can't really get beyond, because you've only got one object, and you can't do the averaging that you can do with these other methods, you can't really get to high resolution. So there is a limitation in tomography. On the other hand, if you were to do tomographic reconstructions in three dimensions of a field of view of thousands of identical particles, even though the individual particle, in terms of its signal-to-noise ratio, would be limited to 20 angstroms, you could later on average them in 3D, and that might be a better approach to some of these. In other words, if everybody gave up what they were doing with their Bessel functions and all this sort of thing, and just did tomography and got 3D maps, and then did the averaging after the tomography, rather than trying to do the averaging in terms of the maths of the programs, that might also be quite a good approach. So there are lots to be done, and the field has a lot more potential, I think, than many of the other areas that we won't mention. So the idea is to go through a couple of examples, just very quickly, of each of them. And of course, I'll kind of dwell most on our way of looking at it in the single particle thing. But so first, and of course, apologies to those who actually came to the earlier lectures, but nonetheless, the first one was just to touch on 2D crystals. And this is 2D crystal bacteriodopsin after image processing. So we've done all the averaging, we've got rid of the noise, and as an example of what you can do, you can then look at the different structural changes, and what we had was this, a ground state and an intermediate with a several angstrom structural change, which we think is part of the understanding of the mechanism. So that's a good example, and there are others. And then I also showed on Tuesday Chris Tate's EMRE, which is at low resolution but very informative. There are very few asymmetric homodimers where you have four helices of the same polypeptide but with two completely different arrangements in one asymmetric dimer. And they're just two examples of what you can do with electron crystallography. And then I showed this table also, which was the structures that I knew about that are beyond about 9 or 10 angstroms and so on, including some that were good enough to give you atomic structures. And so that shows that the methodology and the way people are doing it work well enough to get structures. And all these other ones down here, for example, let's say glutathione transferase or the SEC-YEG complex, which are in membrane crystals, these were limited by the disorder of the crystal, because you're using the crystal to treat as a crystal rather than as an individual molecule. So there are limitations there, and that's how well people have been able to do with 2D crystals. But you have to make the crystals. So the second approach, which has been very productive also, is to look at helical arrangements of molecules. And I think many people here will know about or have even collaborated and published papers with Nigel Unwin. And this is one of Nigel's pictures of a tubular array of the acetylcholine receptor, which Alan Brisson from France, who came as a postdoc originally with Nigel when he was at Stanford, had developed this preparation from Torpedo. And it's in ice, so it's a frozen, tubular, highly crystalline, but a sort of one-dimensional order array of the acetylcholine molecules. And Nigel can, you know, you can trap it, you can spray acetylcholine on as it's plunging into the cryogen in a way that would be hard to do in trapping in 3D crystals. And the way he knows he's got acetylcholine, they put a little bit of ferritin in with the acetylcholine. And many people will know, certainly I, Ron Milligan, and others here will have published, Liz Kubelek and so on, will have published papers and know how much of a craftsman Nigel is in doing this. And probably there aren't many others who could have done so well. But Nigel, with his colleagues, Atsuo Mirazawa and Fujiyoshi, have now taken the analysis of this all the way from sort of 20 to 10 to 8 to about 4 angstrom resolution. And they do it by the Bessel function helical analysis. This is a cross-section obtained from just such views. And then this is from Nigel's paper and Atsuo and Yoshi's paper last summer, where you have your cross-sectional view. The red is the part of the acetylcholine signal. The red is the bit in the membrane. This is their model, which is not complete in that the extracellular domain is based on Tishia Sixma's pentameric homodimer of an acetylcholine soluble binding protein and the helices in the membranes, but the bits that join between them are not yet defined, and also the cytoplasmic surface isn't complete. So there's more work to be done there and possibly slightly better resolution to be obtained. But nevertheless, you've got a pretty good model with 5 subunits with 4 helices, 20 alpha helices, and a pore in the middle, and reasonably good densities, good enough to be sure you've got it almost correct in terms of the allocation of particular side chains to particular densities. And that's just one good example of the use of electron microscopy in helical assemblies. And I could only find 5 papers describing sub-10 angstrom resolution structures. One is this, the one with Atsuo, Yoshi, and Nigel. A second one, and in that they used about 250 micrographs of filaments, each of which has about 2,000 molecules in it. So that was about 500,000 or 750,000 molecules that had been imaged and averaged. And the fact that they used Bessel functions and helical theory is just a mathematical procedure. They're actually averaging 750,000 pictures of molecules in the same way you might do with single particles or 2D crystals. Keiichi Namba and his colleagues, around about the same time, and they've been working on bacterial flagella for quite a while. Now, bacterial flagella, they are pretty tough. They stick out of the bacteria, they're waving around, they have to be mechanically strong. They were able to get a similar 4-angstrom map and make an interpretation in terms of the amino acid residues with only a relatively small number. They reckon 40 or 50,000 molecules, so 10 times less than the work on the acetylcholine receptor. And yet, again, they get 4 angstroms. They didn't get 3 angstroms or 5, it's 4. So, again, it's limited in resolution by something in the images, which we'll come back to. But this is a well-ordered helical arrangement, and the result is nicely ordered, too. Ken Downing and his colleagues at Berkeley have pushed the resolution that you could get from the microtubules so that there's an 8-angstrom map, which is good enough then to fit into it an atomic model from either electron crystallography or X-ray crystallography of the alpha-beta tubulin dimers. David Stokes and Chikashi Toyoshima and their colleagues also pushed tubular arrays of the calcium ATPase to an 8-angstrom resolution, and that's where it stands, although in parallel Chikashi has X-ray structures of a couple of different structural forms of the calcium ATPase which do not agree in conformation with what you see in these tubular arrays. So again, you have a kind of complementary situation where you can take the domains with atomic interpretations of those domains and fit them into an electron microscopical 8-angstrom resolution structure and say a lot more about how the molecule works. And then I know Bridget and Clint and the high-throughput AMI have been working on TMV, and we want them to publish a paper with better than 10 angstroms and that. But Wah-Chu did this with micrographs taken by Zheng at Tucson about 15 years ago now, and did this actually when he was on his sabbatical in Cambridge with Tony and actually Linda Amos helping with the helical theory. And that's about it. But again, with helical things, you need to make your helix of your molecule, unless it's one of the naturally occurring ones, like microtubules. And for example, there isn't a high-resolution cryo structure of actin filaments yet. There are lower resolutions, but there isn't one beyond 10. So this would be obviously a really good one for someone to push harder at. Ron, wherever. Yeah. Okay, so that's kind of an overview of how well people are doing with helical arrays. If we now go to single particles, there aren't so many that are there's hundreds that are 10, 20, 30 angstrom resolution, but there aren't so many where people have pushed it, and obviously all of the ones that have been done at 20 angstroms could be done better. But these are the ones that we found, and I talked about hepatitis B yesterday. Wah-Chu's group in Houston, I think they probably have the best, highest resolution, sort of Rice dwarf bar, 6.8 angstroms. Although both of these, there are X-ray structures. Rice dwarf from a group in China, or is it in... Oh, it's Japan, perhaps. And so, Wah told me they're not going to do this anymore because, the X-ray people have overtaken them. But I think they should, actually, because it may be that that's limited entirely by the computing and not by the images they've got. Anyway, there are quite a lot of others. And Tim Baker's group, Wah-Chu's group, and a number of the membranes, Semliki and Simbis, have components in the virus that are part of the membrane envelope of the virus with transmembrane helices and so on. So I think all of these, potentially could be done better. And then if you have non-icosahedral structures, obviously it's harder. There's lower symmetry, so sevenfold, I think it's 13-fold, and I don't know, 622 or so. And the ribosome is the only one that doesn't have any symmetry. And actually, these are kind of honorary 10-angstrom resolutions. It's harder to do. But this is what was published. But I think, actually, they have better maps. All of these are a bit better than that now. So this is how well people have done, if you look at the literature. So what we're talking about today really is not only how well have people done in the past, but what is the potential. And then the idea is, obviously, there's a lot of potential. Otherwise, I would give up and do something else. And so the rest of what I'd like to talk about is a little bit about... with some repetition from yesterday, actually, but how well we can do, or we expect to be able to do, in the single particle area. So, I did talk a little bit about Peter Rosenthal's work, and Peter is the person who's pushed most rigorously and most analytically what we're doing, so we really think we know what we're doing in this structure. And there's this idea that you should... Even if you don't take all your data as tilted pairs, you just take the occasional ones, sort of to keep yourself honest, is quite a good idea. And then, when you get your map at the end, do you just look at it, or do you sharpen it? And if you sharpen it, how do you get rid of high-resolution noise? And then, he's also got this thing, which we touched on yesterday, but I kind of terminated the talk a bit earlier, the number of particles. So, I also showed this slide yesterday, but there are a couple more things in this area that I wanted to talk about. So yesterday I explained, this is our kind of overview of what we're doing with all these different approaches. The red curve being the average value of the structure factor of the structure you're interested in as a function of the resolution squared, 1 over d squared. Here you have all the atoms scattering together, so proportional to n. And here, all the atoms are randomly placed, root n. So you go from n to root n. The slope of that line there at the origin. This is a Guinier plot. That gives you the radius of gyration of your particle. Once you're off that linear part, you're into a part of the curve that depends on the sort of structure of the particle, the low resolution envelope structure. And we call this the shape solvent region. And then there's a dividing line between that and this sort of root N region, where you still get some modulation because alpha helices of beta sheets will cause this to go up and down a bit. But the 10 angstrom boundary is what X-ray crystallographers have known for many years is the resolution where if you've got a crystal and you get its diffraction pattern and then you drop it into higher salt, that so that the density of the solvent between the protein molecules changes, then the diffraction spots below 10 angstroms vary in intensity. The ones higher than 10 angstroms, it's a bit of a simplification, but roughly, don't change. And what that means is that diffraction for most biological molecules beyond 10 angstroms is coming from mainly from internal features, helical packing, beta sheet, where all the atoms are. Whereas below 10 angstroms, it's a sort of envelope effect. So if you've got a thing that's a big sphere with holes in it, or a little compact ball, the nature of the curve here, the shape solvent effect, will be affected. But at higher resolution, it's more to do with the interference between all the atoms, because the shape's cancelled out by then. And that sort of also points up how strong the envelope transform is compared to the average structure factors at high resolution. Because, I mean, in a structure with 100,000 atoms, the square root of 100,000 is 300, so the structure factor here is hundreds of times bigger than it is here. And that's why in our type of cryo-EM, most people are using this envelope function at the moment to do the alignment, and we're not yet into this situation. Okay, also shown here then is, since this is N and root N, and we've normalized it to have root N in the middle, these curves here, the red one is sort of supposed to be a medium-sized structure, like we're interested in, about a million molecular weight. But if you've got a bigger one, that blue line there, obviously has a bigger value of N compared to root N. So it's even stronger. So you have more signal at low resolution. Whereas if you have a smaller structure, then the intersection with the origin gets less. And so you small structure, medium structure, big structure here. And then if you say, okay, I'm going to take only one picture of that structure, and it doesn't matter if it's one view or a tomographic series of views, maybe 60 pictures at 1 or 2 degree intervals, this curve, this scale on the right tells you about the noise level that you get from one or more pictures. And the idea is if you're doing a tomographic reconstruction, so you collect all the data from one unique object, a bit of a cell or a virus or a vesicle with a hole in it or something, you do a tomographic reconstruction, you can only take a picture of the one object, you can't do averaging because they're different, you have that noise level here. And here is the signal. So as the signal comes down, at low resolution, the signal is above the noise, but you cannot get above the noise level. The signal is still in there, but it's below the noise. You cannot get below this resolution. And this is a resolution squared plot. So bigger structures, if you're interested in, will give you perhaps 20 angstroms, smaller ones, 30 or 40 angstroms, but you can never, with one object, really expect to get to high resolution. That's why I say that tomography is always going to be, you can always make it better by having a detector that's got better point spread function, measures all the electrons, but you will always have some limitation because this calculation assumes you've got a perfect detector. Alright, and then the rest of it I talked to you yesterday about, in practice the images you get lose high resolution data, and that causes, instead of it being the structure factor of your object as it ought to be, it's blurred and it's less than that. And if you're averaging things, it's even less because of computation. And in practice, instead of getting out to high resolution with a reasonable number of particles, you can only reach, depending on how well, how blurred it is, you can only reach an intermediate resolution. And we think this is a good way of looking at it because it integrates anything you're doing, and then you can say, well, why am I not doing better? And of course, there might be hundreds of other reasons, like your specimen is complete rubbish. But in principle, and we'll come back to this at the end, if you know what you're doing, you ought to be able to know what, if you do this or that thing differently, like more data or better data, how will that affect the result before you do the work, which is always more comforting. Okay, so that's the overview. I showed this yesterday, which is pyruvate dehydrogenase, which lots of different particles. I showed this, which is the result of averaging about 4,000 or 6,000 of the particles. A 3D reconstruction with icosahedral symmetry. I showed this cross-correlation curve, which if you were to take the two halves of the data that were used to make that, cross-correlate them, you'd get a 50% correlation between the two sets at about 11 angstroms, but if you go down to 15%, then that's about 8.5 or 9 angstrom resolution, and that 15% corresponds to a cross-correlation between all of the data and another structure that you don't have that would be perfect, that would be 50%. And so we're now trying to convince people that they should all work together, they should all believe in the 15%, and then they'll be compatible with X-ray crystallographers. And then I also showed these two curves, which are the tilt angles from a tilt pair of a field of view like that, where you find the tilt angles from the untilted pair, and then you ask what is the phase residual when you tilt it as a function of the tilt angle. And in the middle would be if the two pairs weren't tilted, but we did tilt it by 10 degrees and you get a minimum at 10 degrees, and what that tells you is that the structure you've got and most of the images have good orientations and good data, and in a way it's a sort of validation of the fact that you've done it right. And I think to have one little plot like that as part of a single particle paper now would be one way of certifying, you know, that your work was done really nicely. And this is another way of doing it, which had individual tilts for individual particles. And each one of those symbols comes from a single particle whose orientation is determined on an untilted picture, and another view of the same particle whose orientation is determined from a completely independent picture. And then this little program looks for a tilt axis and a tilt angle that makes, taking into consideration the symmetry, that makes those two independent images agree with one another. There's nothing in the program that tells it that it should be 10 degrees or a particular axis. So this little cluster of points are something like 45 out of 50 measurements of the tilt axis and tilt axis without putting any information in again. So again, this is to have these two plots is a sort of very comforting thing after you publish your paper. Okay, so that's just a kind of recap on what we're doing. And this is the experimental equivalent of that theoretical curve that I showed you before. And again, I showed this one yesterday. The red curve is the experimental value of the structure factor that you get in that reconstruction without any fiddling with it at all as a function of resolution squared. So it goes down, it fades with resolution, and eventually it becomes noise. And what we've done, Peter and I have done this, is to work out what is the proportion of singleton noise, and that's this singleton noise weighting factor, 2c over 1 plus c square rooted. And if you multiply that solid red curve by that second equation here, you get the thin red curve, which is more or less a straight line fading at higher resolution, and then it has the envelope function at low resolution. And the black line and the intercept there are exactly in agreement with the fact we know this structure has essentially about 100, 120,000 carbon atom equivalents of scattering. So, you know, it fits with the theory quite nicely. So what we then do, we measure the slope of that line, which corresponds to a temperature factor apparent of 1,000, which is an enormous temperature factor. So we then take that B factor of 1,000 and we sharpen with e to the plus 1,000 over 4d squared. So at a resolution of, say, 10 angstroms, 10 squared, 400 squared, b is 1,000, so that's e to the 2.5. We're sharpening it by about 15 or 20. So at 10 angstroms, we're making the amplitude 10 times stronger than it is in the raw data. Obviously, 4 angstroms would be much higher. When you do that, you get the red dotted line here. So here it's coming down. And so the red dotted line is a calculation derived from the experimental data that's supposed to be exactly equivalent to the solid red line on the slide 2 slides ago. The blue one is another radial distribution of intensity that comes from an atomic model that was derived from an X-ray structure, not of an icosahedral arrangement of this iobate dehydrogenase domain, but from an Azotobacter homologue that had a 4-3-2 symmetry put into the right symmetry. And then, so the blue line Peter calculated from an atomic model. And you can see it agrees really well in the intercept, in the line and the slope and so on, with the experimental data from the model. And that little dotted line is essentially the form factor and sort of normal temperature factors, you know, 20, 50 and so on. So that really, you know, is from the single particle work, a measurement of the fading of resolution. And we'll come back and compare that to 2D crystals and helices and so on in a minute or two. So the blue then is the density sharpened and dampened from the map, and the yellow is from the model. And that's, you know, in the work that I've been concerned with, this is our best, highest resolution single particle work, which is why I've picked it out. Okay, now a couple of things I missed yesterday. I wanted to show you this, which took, you know, years of thought to get this. The idea of this is, forget about the experiments and just ask, if you start by taking EM pictures of objects, and those with bad eyesight will have to get a copy afterwards, Mary cited. But the idea here is to look at all sorts of different structures, starting from, this is a large virus of 300 megadaltons, going down in size from small viruses, 10 megadaltons, a ribosome, 3 megadaltons, big multimeric enzymes like the ones I've been talking about, 500,000, a small protein, 20,000, a very small protein, 5,000, and then to do calculations of what you expect to get in your electron micrograph without any actual microscope, just knowing about the laws of physics and scattering and cross-sections and so on. And you can ignore all of the columns, actually, because it's published in this Quarterly Reviews of Biophysics, 1995. But the idea is you work out the size of the particle, how many atoms, what is the average structure factor, as a function of high resolution, low resolution, what is the phase contrast, how much dose can you give, what's the noise level, what's the signal to noise, and then can you find the molecule in an EM image by cross-correlation, and that's this column here. And above that line, you can find it. Below it, you can't. Can you find the orientation? Again, above that line, you can. Below it, you can't. And there are equations for calculating all those numbers. But you know, who are interested can look. But anyway, those two lines, this turns out to be about 10 kilodaltons. And this is about 50 kilodaltons. In theory, for a perfect image, limited by radiation damage. And then the idea is, can you detect it? And the answer is, Can you do alignment and find the structure? No, you cannot ever do it below 50 kilodaltons. Above 50, there's a region of sort of uncertainty where technical prowess or improvements in techniques will help, which is possibly. And then the idea is above about 1.5 million, yes, you can do it already, and you might be limited by other things. And then the last two columns are how many pictures do you need to define the projection view of one of them. Large viruses obviously have a lot more signal in, and our criterion here was that the average Fourier component, and this was a calculation for 3 angstrom resolution, should be more than 3 sigma of the noise. So this is quite a conservative criterion. I'll come back to that. So obviously big things have stronger structure factors, so you don't need as many views. Small things, you need a lot of views. But big things need a lot of different views to do the tomography. Small ones need fewer views, and when you work it out, it turns out the number of views you need to get a 3-angstrom structure is independent of the size of the particle. It's about 10,000 if you want 3 sigma. If you only want 1 sigma, it's 1,000. Okay, so what Peter Rosenthal did, and I showed this yesterday, but we didn't have these numbers on it, he took the actual data set of this pyruvate dehydrogenase, which is the white circle, and said, I have reached 8.7 angstroms, because that's what the data tells me in terms of singleton noise, and I needed 3,600 particles. But they were icosahedral, so they had 60 subunits, so really that was more like 200,000 individual asymmetric units. So Peter, with 200,000 particles, reached 8.7 angstroms. Okay, so now, if you remember, say, Nigel Unwin's, the acetylcholine receptor, they reached 4 angstroms with something like 750,000 particles. And what we've also got on here are a series of lines which tell you how much power you've lost from this image blurring and charging and so on. And in Peter's case, from that plot that I showed you, the slope of the line compared to what it should be indicated that you were losing power with an apparent temperature factor of 1,000. So that's the B factor of 1,000 line, and that black dot then comes from the theory in the previous slide, and it shows pretty good agreement. So to do better, one thing you can do is get better images, better order and so on, and if your fading with resolution is only 500 or 250 or 125, then you get to higher resolution. And Nigel, if you remember, reached 4 angstroms with the acetylcholine receptor with about 500,000-700,000 structures and got 4 angstroms. And from that, we would expect that the data that Nigel was using to make his reconstruction was fading as if it had a temperature factor of about 250. So, you know, I've asked Nigel, what is your temperature factor? Of course, he doesn't believe in this kind of thinking necessarily. He has his own particular way of working it out. And he sharpens it and he does it and so on. And it turns out Nigel's way of doing it is that you subtract from the raw structure 85% of a lower resolution version of the same structure. And the effect of that is to take the lower resolution Fourier components and give them 15% of the weight, but you keep the high resolution ones the same. And then in addition, he gives it a temperature factor sharpening of 50. Doesn't like to do more because then you get noise. So what he hasn't got is a sort of theory with a fading function and a proper... So we're trying to persuade him, and I think he will. But basically, if you work out what is 85% plus a temperature factor 50, it comes out about 250. But we think he'd be better off to do it with a theory rather than a sort of subjective idiosyncratic approach that we all know so well. And that's, of course, how he's so successful, has that. Okay, then you go to Keiichi Namba and the flagella, back to the flagella. They only used 40,000 particles, and they reached 4 angstroms. And again, I don't think they have... I should read more carefully, but it'll be in about... So 10,000 would be... If you could get images that had a temperature factor of 125... you'd only really need about 10,000 particles to get to 4 angstroms. So they're in about here, with a temperature factor of about 150. This is a really good thing. It means there's, first of all, your structure is well ordered, and it didn't move much, and the microscope didn't have much charging and so on. So, you know, that's a kind of... and we'll come back to that in a little while. Because at the end, I have some other ones. Okay, so then I thought... There's a really nice young PhD student called John Rubinstein who worked for 3 years with John Walker in Cambridge on the F1FO. And then he did labeling and where is the oligomycin sensitivity conferral protein on the structure and so on. But at the end, he wanted to come for a year or two or so and do some real cryo-EM. And this is a fairly small thing, 500,000 or 600,000 microwaves in detergent and so on. And it isn't at 3 angstroms or 10 angstroms. It's a low resolution thing. But I thought, if I show you this, it shows you that even if you're at the edge of what's possible, you can still pull things out that really help the whole field. So what John did was to take pictures of mitochondrial ATPs in ice and process them. And I'm just going to show you 4 or 5 slides of that work, which is quite informative in a biological sense. And shows that there are hundreds of things we can do with the methods at the moment, even though we can aspire and try things to make them better. So this is the molecule. This is alpha 3 beta 3 gamma delta epsilon. That's the F1 part of the in this case, it's bovine mitochondrial ATP synthase. There is alpha-3, beta-3, gamma-delta, epsilon, and actually Daniela Stock in the lab with John Walker crystallized the yeast version of this enzyme and found in her crystal alpha-3, beta-3, gamma-delta, epsilon, and a ring of 10 of the C subunits, which are thought to rotate, driven by ATP or driven by proton gradient and making ATP. And this is not, this is an X-ray structure, not at a resolution good enough yet to be sure of where the side chains are. So it's about 3.8 or 4 angstroms. There isn't an atomic interpretation of this ring, C10 ring. But the bits that are drawn in are the bits with known structures. The bits that are sort of blobby, A, B, D, F, 6, and so on, there is no atomic structure, although bits of them by NMR, domains of one or the other. And so the idea was, could cryo-EM be used to give you a sort of framework into which you could then put all these structures later? So John simply took this, John Rubinstein, purified in dodecamalticide and took fields of view. And this is a piece of carbon, ice, and these are the ATP synthases. Sometimes they stick together, but he looks for molecules like this, where you can see, and it's got obviously F1 and FO, and this has been seen by negative stain for quite a long time, so you know sort of what you're looking for. So John is picking out pairs of molecules like this, and he picked several thousand of them, and here are 10 of them. So, you know, usually they have a big one, probably F1, and a little one, F0, and then it's very noisy. So the idea, I think, which almost everyone is doing, is to pick one or other of multivariate statistical package and analyze those. And this was John's panel of class sum views from the multivariate statistical analysis of those 4,000 pictures. And you see there's a big... this is, A is the average of all of them, after alignment, of particles he picked himself that looked like they had two blobs. And it's obviously he's got a big N and a little N, so F1 and FO, and then not a lot else. And then, but if you look at the class sum variation, there are all sorts of views, some that look symmetrical, some that are asymmetrical. And the question is, do you believe any of them? And if so, which ones? And what are your arguments behind it? And it, because it's sort of at the edge of what you can do, you can't just plug it into an automatic package. You have to think about it. And I think that's true of other structures, other projects which people have to... Where they're working with things about this size. And so John's idea, John Rubinstein's idea, was that anything that looked symmetrical might be symmetrical, might be the real thing, but it might be that this multivariate statistical package has not been able to distinguish, because there's not enough information in the pictures, between them, and that therefore they might be artifactually mixed up pictures of things that shouldn't really be put into the same group. So he therefore decided he was going to ignore these. They might be right, but they might be wrong, and they're not going to help at the moment. So what he did was he said, well, obviously if you've got a particle in ice, and we're looking for these other subunits, and it's believed there's only one of them, so there should be some asymmetry. So he's looking for asymmetric views. But the second thing he decided was he didn't just want asymmetric views, they're in ice in all orientations. If you find an asymmetric view like that, then there should be an equal number of molecules upside down. So you should see structures with an asymmetry, and you should see the mirror image. And if you don't see that, that's suspicious already. So his idea, and that's what these central eight are, there are four on the left that are asymmetric, and then there are four on the right that look like mirror images of the four on the left. So this one, J, looks like F flipped. G and K look flipped, H and L look flipped, and then I and M look flipped. And then, so these are the eight he decided were his, going to be his gold standard that he was going to start with and work with. And then the other ones he's suspicious of for different reasons. So for example, this one here looks very similar, but it is a bit different, and it doesn't have a mirror pair. So he left that out, although I think later he weakened and he let it go in. So he had 9 in the end. These two he didn't like, because although they're mirror images of one another, they're not as long as these molecules. So his idea of N and O was it was an asymmetric structure, and it was probably tilted slightly away from you. But for every one tilted away from you, there'd be one tilted towards you. So you're, again, the multivariate statistical passage is mixing up, he thought, or it could be mixing up, views that are really completely different, 30 degrees apart, and as soon as you put that into your structure, it's in there, it's a bias in your model, you know, you go round and round, and you'll never extricate yourself from that. So John's idea was to pick only these eight, and then see what he could do with them. And again, he spent quite a while thinking about it, so there's a lot of subjectivity here, and in the end, we'll come back to that, because it's quite suspicious if it's subjective, it might be wrong. So a third idea John had was to take these eight structures and subtract from them, because you sort of know a bit about it already. You know it's got F1, you know there's a stalk, you know that there's the C10 in the membrane, or it might be C12 or C14, or, you know, but there's a ring at the... He's looking for an asymmetrical part, the part no one's found or fell off during crystallization. So what he did was to subtract from these eight the average of all of them, and looking for something that would stand out. And that top eight, then, are the same eight that you saw, the class sums, from which has been subtracted the average of all of them. And then you see a bit of a ridge that he put red crosses along, which moves as you go along. And actually, one thing he did, which is on the web actually, was to take these eight, and using one of the little movie-making programs, he just put them in a sequence. And if you look at that, you can just see it rotating round. And this is what convinced him that he was on the right track, because otherwise you'd never know where you were. So then he got someone, Graham Mitchison, with a mathematical bent, and wrote a little computer program to ask whether the positions of these X's relative to some axis could be fitted in such a way that you could give an angle to each of those views that would be consistent with something rotating. And that's what these... It doesn't prove it's true, so you're not proving anything and it's not rigorous, but it's a self-consistency thing. So he ended up with this nice cosine wave showing the positions of all these particles at different heights. There are other variables that are not plotted. But anyway, it fits the theory. So then he put it together and did a little bit of refinement. And this is the structure he got. It's kind of smooth and so on. And so at this point, interpreting it, there's also an element of subjectivity. So you look at this. This is the big end, the little end. There is a model for F1 and F0. So what John did was actually just to partition it subjectively such that he interpreted part of this structure in terms of what was known. So you could make a model at low resolution from the atomic coordinates. And that's what... These two are the experimental data. This is then a subjective interpretation. The blue being what existed previously in the sort of published database, and the green being the density left over, not explained by the model that, for example, Daniela Stock's C10, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, and so on. And the idea being, of course, that this was F1, F0, and this was the sort of stalk connecting the two together, the stator, so that you could rotate this rotary proton pump against itself. There's some more views, you know, side view, top view. And John had a theory about how this might be floppy, and depending on whether you're creating a proton gradient for ATP or creating ATP from a proton gradient, of course it goes in an opposite direction. And if this is a piece of rope, it might flop back and forward one way or another. And his last thing was to take the model that I showed you at the beginning and try and put it in, just by hand. And it, you know, fits quite well with the green being extra. So the green are these other subunits that are part of the stator. And then I said, well, you know, this is a 30 angstrom resolution map. It's all quite plausible. It provides a framework for it. Why don't you go on and see if you can refine it a bit, so get it to a bit higher resolution by using the model? And actually, John wasn't terribly optimistic about that. So he's now gone to Toronto, back to his country of origin. He's doing transcription factors and RNA polymerase and so on. But the reason he wasn't so keen is that the thing about the ATP synthase, there are three alphas and three betas, and they can rotate round, and they have ADP, ATP, and the vacant site. So there are three conformations for the top. There are then 10 subunits at the bottom that go clicking round with protons. So there are actually something like 10 structures at the bottom and 3 at the top, and then it can go forward and backward, and this is in detergent, you really don't know. So John's view was this is a mixture of perhaps 20 different states. So he had a kind of pessimistic view about it, which suggested that maybe you'll never get beyond 20 or 30 angstroms unless you have some mechanism of locking it. And then the other thing was, if it's going forward or backward, and this is somewhat flexible, when it's going one way, it might slope to the left, and the other way, it would perhaps slope to the right. So you might have 40 different structures. So you have to be a bit careful and probably know a bit more about it to lock it in some state that you have some biochemical evidence for before you try and go to higher. Anyway, that's how it stands, but it's just a message that things that are on the edge of what's capable, and you know, I had a nice talk with Francisco Asturias yesterday about the polymerase. It's about the same size. It has a lot of flexibility on it, and you have to try and get something out of it at the current state of technical progress in addition to trying to make progress in the future. So I think it's good examples of doing good biology alongside trying to push the methodology forward a bit. Okay, we're in quite a good time now. So last one, I thought, lots of people have done lots of great tomography, and I just wanted to refer to it because in a way, what you're doing is exactly the same, and it may be there's a lot of potential in the future, as yet unrealized, for using tomography alongside the higher resolution methods. Although, I have to say, trying to get 3 angstrom resolution pictures with 60 degree tilts is probably quite hard, but the dose is very small. Anyway, I thought I'd just show you an example, and this is Sam Lee, who's a great, he used to work with in Salt Lake City but he came to the lab, and he's the only one in Cambridge in LMB doing tomography with a 2K squared CCD, and he came to work with John Kilmartin, who had developed a really great purification procedure for yeast spindles. So with the spindle pole bodies at each end, the microtubules in between, part of the dividing yeast cell. And this is one of a series, minus 60 to plus 60, 1.5 degree steps, 2K CCD, tomographic tilt series of a microtubule spindle with gold particles sprinkled on it to use as fiducial marks to align the different images. And so you do tomography, and I think he uses Spider, some home-written software, and Amira, some software for doing it. This is a slice of the tomographic reconstruction. This is his picture of one half of the spindle, and the other half in a different color. So it's a nice sort of 50, 60, 70 angstrom resolution piece of biology using essentially the same equipment, the same methodology as we're using for all of these other projects. Okay, so what I've told you was to try and give you a kind of overview of the similarity and differences between electron crystallography, helical analysis, single particles, and tomography in a sort of integrated way. And I actually wanted to finish by trying to point out what are some of the potential problems that need to be, you know, realized or solved and so on. So I put in the 3 or 4 slides that I didn't quite reach yesterday, so this is sort of, which is to do with contrast loss in low-dose images. And these are pictures that, you know, some have taken 10 years ago of tobacco mosaic virus in ice, and of course it was an old prep, tobacco mosaic virus discs also in ice, with a diffraction pattern of that filament. So this is 27 angstroms, 13 angstroms. This is 23 and 11 angstroms. So they're reasonable pictures, similar to pictures others have obtained. And actually, I did check by asking people to contribute their best TMV pictures. And they're all very similar. So there wasn't, you know, nothing stood out particularly. And also, there was the paper by Wachu and Zheng that I mentioned earlier with the 10 angstrom reconstruction. So what we did was to take these diffraction patterns and compare them with the amplitude of those diffracted layer line peaks, compare them with what we knew that the amplitudes ought to be, not by electron diffraction because you can't do it, but this is an X-ray pattern from Ken Holmes, Gerald Stubbs, K.G. Namba, from decades ago. And it, of course, it actually goes all the way out to 2 angstroms, so there's no fade out. It's just, you know. And you can pick out various peaks, which you can see in the electron pattern. And there's not a lot of difference between electron and X-ray relative scattering powers. So you can take those amplitudes and compare them, again, on a function of resolution. Could be squared, but, you know. This is the electron image versus the X-ray pattern. This is Zheng, Crowther, Wah, and someone. And then this was that picture that I just showed you, plotting it. And you can see it's fading out a lot. So you've got about a factor of 10 here to 7 angstroms. And if you take that data and transfer it onto the same kind of plot that I showed you for the 2D crystals, because as I'm saying, these are all the same. This is the fade-out of a room temperature bacteriorhodopsin electron crystallographic image versus the electron diffraction pattern, fading out so you only get 7 angstroms. Here is the best picture we ever had, which has a fade-out relative to not fading out, equivalent to a B factor of 120. If all our pictures were like this, you wouldn't need very many to get the structure at all, 10 or something like that, at high resolution. But there's a big difference between 750 and 120. But this TMV in ice turns out to be virtually 1,000. And you remember what I said, enzyme 2 catalytic domain, it's 1,000. All these virus structures, the icosahedral ones, they all fade out at 7, 8, 9, 10. They're all in this region, 500, 600, 700. They're all fading out. And the reason that you don't get 3 angstroms is exactly because of this this problem. So what, you know, you have to do something to make it, because you really need about, you could have fade out, but 250 is about, if you can get your pictures to be such that the amplitudes in them are fading relative to what they should be, equivalent to a B factor about 250, then you're into this, you're over this barrier, so you can get atomic resolution. Below that, you have to have blobs, and then, and you know, integrating with other data. But there's a continuum for what you can do. Okay, so then, this is the last remark, really. What do I think are the problems? I mean, obviously there are lots of other ones as well, but these ones would probably have the biggest effect on the most number of projects. The first one is that the images we get are blurred because they're charging and moving and so on. So that, if you could fix that by some magic method or bright idea and so on, that would have the biggest effect on everybody's work because it would affect whatever you're doing. Secondly, I mean, obviously we all do our best to find orientations if it's in a single particle one. If it's a big single particle like a virus, 70 megadaltons, probably doesn't matter. Probably you're doing it well enough and it's limited by other things in your image, like differential magnifications, things like that. But for smaller particles, and there are a lot more small structures than big structures that we would like to know, little machines and so on, 500,000, 1,000,000. So this, getting this orientation determination right, or getting a method that somehow or other describes your uncertainty in a rigorous way. And in the X-ray crystallographic, if they have bad phases, you know, they've got these maximum entropy, maximum likelihood methods. And people are discussing this. And the field, electron cryo microscopy, is beginning to attract some of the sort of mathematical whiz kids who have been in the X-ray crystallography field because they think they've solved that, which is probably nearly true. And yet there are lots of things here that really need people with a physical mathematical background. So that would be another thing that would be a great. And then the third one isn't so hard, but you need, in order to, the idea is, you know, certain of the parameters of electron microscope images, pincushion distortion, astigmatism, beam tilt, differential magnification in two different directions in the microscope. People are not correcting for this. And the reason that they're not correcting is that they don't think it matters. And it probably doesn't if your images are not good enough. So these probably, people will not feel compelled to include this in their image processing until you've got better images. And then they, you know, so it'll go, it's a sort of chicken and egg situation. No one's doing this because they don't think the images are good enough. So these three go together. And then the last thing, which I think would be good, is if people in the field could somehow or other come together and agree on what constitutes a proof that you've got the right answer. And, you know, we had this a bit in crystallography. We had the free R factor. Before that, we had mistakes and so on. And I know there are papers in the literature done by electron cryo microscopy, and the result is just wrong. We know it's wrong, but we don't know quite why, and there's no criterion. So I think developing some better validation criteria, perhaps by emitting some of the data or collecting some extra little bit of data like this tilt pair, so that you are independently checking it. And Joachim Frank recently had some theoretical tests with ribosomes in PNAS, where they left out a certain region of reciprocal space of the data as a block, and then compared noise to real data. And of course, the noise, you get nothing back in that. You get your starting structure back from the noise, but you don't get the missing bit. So some extra data validating it would be a good idea. All right, so I hope that's... So we need non-cryo-EM people to join in the field, because there's so much to be done. So I hope there are some who are willing to do that. Thank you very much. Yeah.